Humpty Dumpty. It can't be anyone else. And he looks exactly like a giant egg.
Young lady, it's not very nice to tell someone he looks like an egg.
Some eggs are very beautiful, you know.
Some people have no more sense than a baby.
My name's Alice, sir.
That's a stupid name.
I may be stupid, sir, but don't you think it'd be a lot safer down here on the ground? The wall is very narrow.
Of course I don't think so. Why, even if I did fall off, the king has promised
that... He sent all of his horses and all of his men to put Humpty Dumpty back together again.
You've been snooping at doors, or you couldn't have known that.
Oh, no. It's in a book of very famous nursery rhymes. What a beautiful butt you've got.
Really? When a person doesn't know a cravat from a belt. It's a cravat, child, and a very beautiful one, I might add. It's a present from the White King and Queen.
Really?
Yes, really. They gave it to me for an unbirthday present just this past week.
An unbirthday present? What's an unbirthday present?
It's a present given when it isn't your birthday, of course.
I like birthday presents best.
You don't know what you're talking about. How many days are there in the year?
365.
And how many birthdays do you have?
One.
And if you take one from 365, that means you can get 364 unbirthday presents. You see, dum-dum?
Certainly.
And only one for birthday presents, you know. Now, there's glory for you.
But I don't know what you mean by glory.
Of course you don't, till I tell you. I mean, there's a nice knockdown argument for you.
But glory doesn't mean a nice knockdown argument.
When I use a word, it means just what I choose it to mean. Neither more nor less.
The question is whether you can make words mean so many different things.
The question is which is to be master. That's all.
Yeah, that's the question. Which is to be master? And the one that controls the words, that's the master. So, hi, folks. Pete Hendrickson here. This is the second hour of the show. I hope that that all of you were with us for the first. We're talking about words and their meanings and the effort to manipulate them in service to political agendi. And if you missed the first hour, I will encourage you to go back to the archive later and give it a listen. We covered some interesting things, kind of focused there for the most part on the transgender insanity that is taking root in America today, in my opinion, very much to its harm. Check out that hour, and you'll see why I say this, and you know, maybe you'll agree with me, maybe you won't. Right now, I want to shift to another form of word manipulation, and this is one that concerns a subject in the news right now, in part because with the Biden administration currently exercising power out of Washington, there is a new push on for gun control of one kind or another. A lot of new fictional nonsense about gun violence that is in the news and being pumped out by the political class in Washington and in a number of states. And so the Second Amendment is a hot topic right now and is likely to stay one for a little while. And the Second Amendment is an area that has had its own special kind of word manipulation that has gone on for many, many, many years now, decades, in fact. And this is a subtler sort of manipulation than what we spoke about in the last hour. Last hour we touched on equity as a concept for one thing, and the plain change in meaning from, you know, one pretty clear and explicit meaning of that term in the past to how it is being used today, and the effort to to get people to be using the term and accepting the use of the term without really understanding the distinction and therefore what it is that they're accepting or what it is that they're saying when they use that term now, with the redefinition in place. Same thing with gender. And that's what led us into the transgender thing. Here in the Second Amendment, this was brought to my mind just recently. I was reading an article on the current efforts to initiate regulation, federal regulation of what are called ghost guns. And these are guns that are manufactured by individuals in their own homes, and they're called ghost guns because being self-made, they of course don't have serial numbers on them or other identifying marks that make them traceable and enable registration or, you know, other forms of record keeping and tracking on these things. And to some people, that's troublesome. And in the article on this ghost gun regulation proposition, which actually ended up going to a good place in that the author, acknowledged that there wasn't any proper oversight or regulation of ghost guns, and used the example of the Lexington and Concord conflict, in which the shot that was heard around the world got fired as the good example. That was an occasion where the British were attempting to seize the colonists' weapons, and in order to prevent them from being able to defend their rights, and so the author was going in the right direction, but he used a phrase that caught my eye and led to the production of another little article in the Lost Horizons newsletter of yesterday, and which again can be found. Go to losthorizons.com, click on news in the news link in the masthead at the top of the page, and you'll get to that newsletter. And I'm gonna read through this article. It's a short little article, and touch on this. The thing that caught my eye was the use by the author of the piece on ghost guns of the phrase peaceful law-abiding citizens as being the targets of the Second Amendment, the people for whom the Second Amendment was written. He says, as so many people do and have done for decades now, there's been this effort to kind of placate the opponents of gun rights with this proposition that the gun rights are there for peaceful law-abiding citizens, and it kind of the implication is that they protect your right to defend your house against burglars or go deer hunting in the autumn. Not the case. And so here's this little article. The title is "The Second Amendment is Not for Peaceful Law-Abiding Citizens," and the subtitle, quite the contrary. And here we go. In reading a piece arguing against newly proposed regulation of so-called ghost guns the other day, I found myself rolling my eyes upon encountering the phrase peaceful law-abiding citizens as the purportedly intended beneficiaries of the Second Amendment. That's the amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which secures the right of every American to keep and bear arms. This might have been my 500th such encounter over the years. The unthinking deployment of this peaceful law-abiding citizen phrase by even those who imagine themselves passionate supporters of the right to keep and bear arms is obnoxiously, if thoughtlessly, routine. Realizing that the subject of the amendment is once again being put into political play by Democrat snowflakes and statists on several fronts right now, in regard to ghost guns and so-called assault weapons, for instance, I think this is a good time to set the record straight, once again, on the true character of those on whose behalf it exists. I speak of decidedly unpeaceful and law-defying citizens, and without intending so much as a speck of literary art in that description. The Second Amendment, in a nutshell, secures the right of fed-up Americans to ignore any law prohibiting the violent overthrow of the existing domestic regime, or any other law implicated by their chosen course, and shoot their way through Washington or any state capital in order to restore the republic. It secures the right of Americans to defend themselves with force in any way they see fit against governance, which is being imposed on them against their will. Now, optimally, such violence will only be deployed upon the failure of the people's efforts to defend themselves through the ballot box. but there's no actual requirement to that effect. That is, the Second Amendment is written to secure the rights of violent men and women who have lost respect for what may nominally be relevant laws, but which are but the tyrant's will, as described by Thomas Jefferson in his observation, "Rightful liberty is unobstructed action according to our will within limits drawn around us by the equal rights of others." I do not add within the limits of the law, because law is often but the tyrant's will, and always so when it violates the rights of the individual. Now, don't misunderstand, it's not just me saying any of the foregoing. The very same violent folks who broke a dozen laws of the government under which they were born and who wrote and adopted the Second Amendment say just what I said. You can see their words in a complete legal analysis of the amendment in an article to which I provide a link in this newsletter article. I go on to say, please read through that compilation and analysis and then pass it around. We have Independence Day coming up fast, and it's pretty important that all Americans have a clear picture of what that's really all about. And I go on to say, in the same vein, as you celebrate the anniversary this year especially, please seriously consider the recital of what I call the proper American Pledge of Allegiance at your gathering. I'm going to share that proper Pledge of Allegiance with you right now, and here's the page on which the text is found and the introductory remarks. This page is titled, "We Need a New Pledge of Allegiance." And I go on to say, let's be done with the old socialist-written jingoistic drivel and start speaking like real Americans. So seriously, folks, why are we more than a century deep into endless recitation of socialist Francis Bellamy's flag chant? The thing is so indelibly tinged with state idolatry, whether due to jingoistic appropriation of the thing over the decades or otherwise, that you would imagine us all to be living in 19th century Prussia. Accordingly, I have undertaken to offer America a replacement. I think you will all agree that this alternative, which uses for the most part the exact expression of our founding principles as presented in the Declaration of Independence, partakes of the real spirit which should infuse anything ritualistically recited, whether in schools, at sporting events, in political rallies, or anywhere else, by men and women lucky enough to be the heirs of our magnificent founders. And here then is the text of the proper American Pledge of Allegiance as I conceive it. I pledge allegiance to the principles of the United States of America, holding that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I hold further that it is to secure these rights that governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, and that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to effect their safety and happiness. Now, I strongly encourage everyone to replace the current, you know, widely used Pledge of Allegiance with that more American Pledge of Allegiance. You folks make your own call, of course. But if you want to find that that pledge in order to make use of it and to help encourage its general replacement of the previous version, which says nothing really at all about our American principles. You can do so at LostHorizons.com/thepledge.pdf. And there's a capital T on the and a capital P on pledge and no space in between. So LostHorizons.com/thepledge.pdf. Download that and spread it around, and I think it will help wake people up a bit rather than put them to sleep the way the existing Pledge of Allegiance does. So I had said in the article that I read to you that the people who wrote the Second Amendment felt the same way about it that I do. And by the way, I'm not advocating any kind of, you know, decisions or behavior or whatever from anybody. with my observation that the amendment is written for violent, lawless people. The fact is that it was. It was not for peaceful, law-abiding citizens. It was for citizens who have decided that they cannot any longer remain peaceful and that they are not intending to abide by any laws that inhibit or prohibit them asserting their sovereignty and taking charge of the political structure within which they find themselves, because that is their right. The citizens are the sovereigns in this country, and it's just that simple. So I want to in the article to which I refer you, that's actually 9 pages of discussion, detailed drill down discussion on the Second Amendment, both its history and the meaning of the words and phrases within that amendment. I'm not going to read the whole thing to you because we frankly wouldn't have time. But I do want to share a couple of the supporting materials that are quoted in the article to make the point that this is in fact the purpose of the Second Amendment, and there's no secret or mystery about that. This is United States Supreme Court Justice Joseph Story in his Commentaries on the Constitution of the United States, written in 1833. This is one of the most broadly respected analyses of the Constitution, and Story says this: the right of citizens, in part, says this: the right of the citizens to keep and bear arms has justly been considered as the palladium of the liberties of a republic, since it offers a strong moral check against the usurpation and arbitrary power of rulers, which I insert a note saying, meaning that they're on notice that bad behavior will be punished. And will generally, even if these are successful in the first instance, enable the people to resist and triumph over them. In other words, it will enable people to resist the usurpation and arbitrary power of rulers and triumph over that usurpation and arbitrary power and the people attempting to exercise it. So I don't think it can be a whole lot more clear than that. That is the an official Supreme Court, you know, early days, a founding generation or near founding generation recital of the meaning of the Second Amendment. Here is give this one a little more space. This is Thomas Cooley, Justice of the Michigan Supreme Court, in his Principles of Constitutional Law, written in 1880, also a very widely respected analysis of the constitutional principles. He says, the Second Amendment, like most other provisions in the Constitution, has a history. It was adopted with some modification and enlargement from the English Bill of Rights of 1688, where it stood as a protest against arbitrary action of the overturned dynasty in disarming the people, and as a pledge of the new rulers that this tyrannical action should cease. The right declared was meant to be a strong moral check against the usurpation and arbitrary power of rulers, and as a necessary and efficient means of regaining rights when temporarily overturned by usurpation. Cooley goes on to say, the right is general. It may be supposed from the phraseology of this provision that the right to keep and bear arms was only guaranteed to the militia, but this would be an interpretation not warranted by the intent. The militia, as has been elsewhere explained, consists of those persons who, under the law, are liable to the performance of military duty and are officered and enrolled for service when called upon. But the law may make provision for the enrollment of all who are fit to perform military duty, or of a small number only, or it may wholly omit to make any provision at all. And if the right were limited to those enrolled, the purpose of this guarantee might be defeated altogether by the action or neglect to act of the government it was meant to hold in check. The meaning of the provision undoubtedly is that the people from whom the militia must be taken shall have the right to keep and bear arms, and they need no permission or regulation of law for the purpose. But this enables the government to have a well-regulated militia, for to bear arms implies something more than merely keeping. It implies the learning to handle and use them in a way that makes those who keep them ready for their efficient use. In other words, it implies the right to meet for voluntary discipline in arms, observing in doing so the laws of public order. And then one last comment. This also from a federal judge. This is Federal Appellate Judge Alex Kaczynski of the Ninth Circuit. And this was said by Kaczynski in a 2003 case of Severa versus Lockyer. He said, "The prospect of tyranny may not grab the headlines the way vivid stories of gun crime routinely do. But few saw the Third Reich coming until it was too late. The Second Amendment is a doomsday provision, one designed for those exceptionally rare circumstances where all other rights have failed, where the government refuses to stand for re-election and silences those who protest, where courts have lost the courage to oppose or confine no one to enforce their decrees. However improbable these contingencies may seem today, facing them unprepared is a mistake a free people get to make only once." I'll leave it at that. The that article in its entirety, as I said earlier, goes on for a total of 9 pages to explain in great detail and in granular detail the nature and meaning of the Second Amendment on a pretty nearly a word-by-word basis. I encourage everyone to read it through. The link for it will be found at the article to which I referred you all and which I read to you a few minutes ago. Please check it out. Read this this analysis of the Second Amendment. Share it around. It really is rather important that that you and everyone you know all there is to know about this important amendment. It's not because, you know, that there's any reason to think that it has, you know, immediate significance today, but you never know when it's going to have significance. And when that time comes, like Kaczynski said, you don't get to make a mistake on that one and get away with it. So we have the bottom of the hour break coming on right now. Please stay with me. We will be back on the other side for more. And we'll see you then.
As you all know, everything begins with an idea. Ideas have helped shape the very world we live in. ThePowerMall.com began as an idea, allowing entrepreneurs and small business owners like yourself the opportunity to not only survive, but thrive in an era where corporations dominate. ThePowerMall.com is a small family-owned business who has partnered with companies you've come to rely on and trust over the years, like North American Urban Spice, Miracle 2 Soaps, Vitamir, Numana Food Storage, to name just a few. Fight back against large corporations when you buy from thepowermall.com. Need to speak to a real person? Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
Hi, this is Power Hour J. We've been spring cleaning at the Power Mall. We have an overstock of Grown by Nature supplements, and we'd like to offer you 25% off of select products. Hurry, the sale will only be available while supplies last. No code necessary to shop at thepowermall.com, or you can call J at 877-817-9829. That's thepowermall.com or 877-817-9829.
Boost your immune system naturally this year with oil of oregano, a potent germ killer. This is the true wild oregano oil P73, a blend of edible spices of wild oregano grown on natural mineral-rich soils. Research published in the International Journal of Food Microbiology found that oil of oregano is an excellent germicide capable of killing a wide range of fungi and bacteria. Get it today by visiting thepowermall.com or calling 877-817-9829.
Hi, this is Jay at the Power Mall.
I thought I would discuss an item that's very valuable to my personal health and well-being. That product is called Curcumin X4000. Its potent antioxidant properties have been shown to decrease swelling and allow us to enjoy our golden years. Take control over your health today, guys. Order Curcumin by calling 877-817-9829 or order at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
Okay, we're back. I want to echo the urging during the break there to visit the Power Mall. It is a place with great products and is operated by great people. And your support of the Power Mall helps keep this radio show on the air. So. Your patronage is much appreciated there. Now we were talking about words and the abuse of words and you know there's another word that is in broad usage out there today. And that word is narrative. This is a word that you're not going to hear much from the people engaging in narrative maintenance, narrative manufacture, narrative maintenance, which is to say the mainstream media, the political class, advocates of one thing or another, especially a new thing, a change, destruction of the traditional and in the embrace of the novel. But what those folks engage in order to further their purposes are what are can be referred to as narratives. The idea is if you can create a storyline that suits the picture of the world that you want, you can steer people's thinking. You can steer the thinking of your audience, and control what it is that they perceive. And we actually had an interesting example of it during the top of the hour break. Those of you that had tuned in, you'll have heard the station has recently added a news feed section to that top of the hour break. I'm really, really delighted about that. I think it's a really nice change. But one of the things that showed up in that news feed was basically a push for vaccinations. A lot was said in a short period of time by the voice that was being recording that was being played there to represent the position or expression of the purpose of the person being reported on in that news blurb. And the vaccine thing is a fascinating narrative. As in that little push, we were told that the vaccines are safe and effective and everybody's got to get one and, keep going with the vaccines because they'll, keep the variants down and protect us, going into the future and on and on. And, that in and of itself is all a narrative. The safe and effective thing is a narrative concept. It's the narrative repetition of this, kind of hypnotic drumbeat declaration, which is a lie. It is a frankly nonsense. And if you were able to pin down, if you were in a position to force a question on the people reciting that safe and effective thing, they would end up admitting, and you can find the evidence of this yourself by looking closely enough. It's not made easy to find because the folks in charge of the narrative, which is the big picture, the picture that you hear from NBC and CNN and ABC and and the World Health Organization and the CDC and the Biden administration and all of those people, that they all share a narrative interest. They don't want you to find these things, and so they're made hard to find. But even any of the spokespeople for them would acknowledge, if pressed, and if you were ever given the opportunity to ask the questions, and if you pay attention, you'll notice that no one ever does ask these questions. They're not given the opportunity, or the people who are allowed to ask questions at all share the narrative interest, or are just generally ignorant of this. They've drunk the Kool-Aid that the narrative is putting forward. But the vaccines, safe? No, they're not. The number of adverse reactions to these vaccines are hugely higher, orders of magnitude higher than what has caused previous vaccines for other dangerous illnesses, and in some cases really seriously dangerous illnesses, as you know, opposed to the COVID-19 thing, which has got the threat of a mild seasonal flu, and really even less than that for the larger part of the population. It's dangerous as a seasonal flu to elderly, frail people, and almost no danger at all to anyone else. But the safe thing, the number of adverse reactions from the vaccine has already recorded adverse reactions that far exceed the numbers that shut down vaccination programs in the past for for everything else. I don't believe there's ever been a vaccination program with anywhere near this level of adverse events, including outright fatalities. In fact, just a couple of weeks ago, the World Health Organization itself acknowledged that the vaccines have a particular threat to younger people, and has actually, on its own website, the WHO has declined now to recommend the vaccination of people under 18. This was a very quiet change that took place after the news became unsuppressible that in males in particular, but in people under the age of 18, an eruption of a condition called myocarditis, which is an inflammation of the heart, has been found at levels 26 times the norm amongst young people who have been vaccinated. And so the WHO has actually on its website now, under the Who Should Get Vaccinated listing on its vaccine advice page, it says children should not be vaccinated for the moment. And by children, it means people under the age of 18. It says the COVID vaccines are safe for most people 18 years and older, but children should not be vaccinated for the moment. And it goes on to kind of get mealy-mouthed about this, says there's not yet enough evidence on the use of vaccines against COVID-19 in children to make recommendations for children to be vaccinated against COVID-19. Children and adolescents tend to have milder disease compared to adults. That's a careful way of getting around the fact that previously children were expected to get vaccinated, and there is a huge push on to vaccinate children across the country right now. In fact, going so far as to be treated as a requirement in schools, in many cases, and particularly in colleges where students wanting to return to campus for college or go to campus for the first time as freshmen are being required to be vaccinated in order to come on campus at most, if not all, colleges with in-person classes in this country. And this despite the fact that getting the vaccine for these kids is dangerous. It's outright dangerous. It was dangerous even before the discovery of this myocarditis problem. As I said, a lot of people have died from this vaccine, and there have been many, many other adverse events. And this reflects the fact that these vaccines have not been tested. Now, you know, that's another part of the mantra that we have heard over and over and over again over the course of the last 6 months, that these vaccines have been tested. But you know perfectly well that this is not true. These things were only created and put into experimental or emergency use, which is to say remaining as experimental drugs, in October, this past October. So they cannot have been tested. They have no track record. No one has ever seen what happens to these things a year after anyone has had one, or 2 years after anyone has had one, or 5 years after anyone has had one. We don't know. We don't know anything about the safety record, except for we know that a lot of people have died from receiving the vaccine. We know that lots of people have become reinfected or have become infected with COVID-19, or at least reportedly have become infected with it after receiving the vaccine. In fact, there was just an article I saw earlier today on Massachusetts having found a new batch of 4,000 people, 4,000 vaccinated people now have the disease. So it is not safe, and in fact, it's not effective either. People continue to catch COVID-19 even after being vaccinated. Now, in the case of kids, not only is there a particularized danger for kids, but kids don't suffer anything from this disease. The number of incidents of children actually having severe adverse effects from being infected with COVID-19 are, I have seen the stat, literally 1 in a million. 1 in a million. And in those cases as well, and I can't say that I've seen this definitively established, but it would not surprise me to discover that that 1 in a million case was a kid that already had a pre-existing comorbidity of some variety or another. The sad fact is there are children that that start out with bad health situations, and those children are unfortunately vulnerable to the complicating elements that contribute to their situation. So, in general, kids are at no risk. They're under no threat whatsoever, meaningfully, from catching the disease, from catching COVID. They are under a threat from receiving a vaccine, and yet the narrative managers, who for some reason really, really, really want everybody to get this vaccine, disregard that, use the safe and effective thing, and just roll forward like a juggernaut, brooking no dissent or resistance or what have you. They don't want you to think about the fact that there have been adverse reactions, and in a considerable volume of adverse reactions, a volume, as I said earlier, that would normally have shut down this vaccination program long since. It would have been shut down 5 months ago, as these numbers began accumulating, starting in December when the vaccines were first being injected into people's bodies. The development of variants, or the appearance of variants. First of all, I personally have some question about the reality of that, just as there was so many things were revealed by this pandemic experience over the last year that proved to be completely false, but nonetheless were, you know, told to us with great grim faces and great seriousness, and then later investigation proved that what was being said was complete nonsense. That one has to wonder about the real truth involved in the claims of the appearance of variants. It certainly is convenient for those who have benefited from and are, you know, wanting to maintain the benefits from having America and much of the rest of the world in a crisis mode Certainly, what could be better than to be able to say, well, it's just this, you know, kind of endless series of new versions of the thing that just, you know, continue to require that we retain a thumb over, you know, the state or the country or the world, and continue to have an excuse for issuing authoritarian decrees, and for not relinquishing power and just letting things return to normal. It's a very convenient proposition that these variants occur. But a number of specialists in the field have made powerful arguments that any variants that do exist are a consequence of putting into people's bodies a vaccine, which really isn't a vaccine. This is the vaccine that is being used, the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines and the Johnson & Johnson. These are not actually COVID-19 viruses that have been weakened or killed and that are being injected in your body so that your body can learn what they are, recognize them, develop antibodies against them, and be prepared in the future for dealing with an infection from any of these things, the way a normal vaccine is. That's what a normal vaccine consists of. It's a dead or weakened cell of the, or sample of the threat. In this case, this is an mRNA vaccine. It's a genetic instruction telling your own cells to create one little part of the virus, the coronavirus, the spike protein component. And your cells are instructed to create this, to produce these spike proteins. And the object is that they will then be recognized as an invader and your immune system will, prepare antibodies to address the spike protein, but only the spike protein. This is part of the problem here. The coronavirus consists of many, many more components than just the spike protein, 1,000 more components than just the spike protein. And yet the protection that is being had from these quote unquote vaccines is only against the one thing. And so our argument of these specialists is that the wide distribution of the vaccine is prompting the generation of variants, or could prompt the generation of variants. They're not going so far as to say definitively that there actually are any variants, but the potential for creating them exists because of the nature of this vaccine. Because when an infection does occur, the antibodies that are produced will only be capable of addressing the specific spike protein that the mRNA vaccine is designed to recognize and address. Any slight change in the virus that is a component of the infection, or any changes that take place while the virus is there, will evade the detection and defensive response of that very, very narrowly oriented immune response. And that will allow at that point a variant to flourish and become transmissible. And so the bottom line there is that the vaccines themselves, if there is a variant issue arising, it is very likely the vaccines themselves that are producing them. There's also the fact that the spike protein by itself is by itself a pathogen. It causes vascular damage. Probably one of the reasons why the myocarditis is occurring, that being an inflammation, it's a vascular problem. The spike protein causes vascular damage. And so just causing people's bodies to produce the spike protein is itself a harm-generating mechanism. We're getting the push on to maintain vaccination, to just continue to vaccinate more and more people. This is also done, by the way, without any regard to the number of people and the status of the number of people who have been infected with COVID-19 and have overcome it, which is the vast majority of people with any connection to COVID at all. And it actually is a very, very, very big number. If you track the course of the distribution of COVID-19 over the course of the first 4 months or so from its eruption up just to the point where any kind of mitigation measures, such as, you know, the lockdowns and so forth, began in mid-March, you track that and model it against the CDC's tracking of the flu virus, which was about at the same time. The COVID virus actually first appeared or first was spoken of in late October of 2019. The first cases appeared in late November. The first acknowledgement was in mid-December or early December. And then it wasn't until mid-March that any effort to mitigate, that it was treated as a a big threat, and any effort to mitigate began. And in that period of time, the seasonal flu also had erupted about the same time in October, and also tracked its course up through that point, as the seasonal flu always does at that during that time of year. And the CDC at that point put the seasonal flu in infection rate, the actual case rate, the number of people who actually caught the flu during that period of time, in the neighborhood I'm going to get to the exact number actually, and I will tell you. Give me 1 second here. Okay. Yeah, I've got to do some clicking on things here to get to the. Get to the data. Okay. In that period of time, there were, according to the CDC, by March 14th of 2020, there had been 38 million to 54 million cases of flu since October 2019, just in the USA. Now, this is just in the US. 38 million to 54 million cases of flu. And C19, COVID-19, during the same period of time, we are told, is a much more contagious disease. There was no restriction whatsoever on the manner in which it was being communicated around. People flew out of Wuhan, China, in huge numbers. Wuhan is a very busy place, and people travel all over the world from Wuhan. And then they travel into places from which other people travel all over the world. And this went on. There were actually from late November or early December of 2019 to mid-March of 2020, 1 billion people flew on airplanes from everywhere to everywhere. And this included tens of millions flying into all points of the United States from places like Wuhan, China, infected areas of Italy, other places to which people infected elsewhere had traveled, in short, from everywhere. So during that same period of time, it is just the simplest of logic to conclude that somewhere in the neighborhood of 38 million to 54 million people contracted COVID. They did. It's a much more contagious disease, and it was being distributed in the same vectors that the flu was. And the flu, which also, by the way, comes from Southeast Asia. So we had an exact model of what was going on. And from that model, it is only reasonable to conclude that at minimum, 38 million to 54 million Americans were infected with COVID-19 just during that initial 3.5 month period. And then, of course, we've had, another year went by, and another year plus to bring us to today. And in that period of time, millions and millions and millions of Americans had contact with other millions and millions and millions of Americans. And so this thing will have spread. There will have been vast numbers of Americans infected with this, asymptomatically in most cases, because as I said earlier, unless you're frail and elderly, this disease really is not dangerous to you at all. You may get the effects of a head cold, and you may not even notice that, but you will have had the disease, and your system will have defeated it, and your system will then be equipped with a robust, durable antibody population, which is capable of defeating not only the original virus, but actually any variants as well, because a natural immunity, unlike the immunity that is produced from these non-vaccine vaccines, which only looks at the spike protein, a natural immunity parses out every little component of the virus, so all 1,000 parts, and develops antibody protection against all of them. All of them are recognizable. All of them will be fought when they arrive. And a human, a healthy human immune system is a bear of a critter. It defeats readily, handily defeats all manner of threats constantly, and it's a very powerful thing. And in fact, there are crossovers as well. You know, having developed an immunity against a coronavirus provides some immune protection against any coronavirus. So it isn't even just a matter of having had to be infected with COVID-19. You can have been infected with the flu or even a common cold or other coronaviruses, of which there are many, many, many in circulation at all times, and have achieved some immune response, some pre-existing immune response protection against COVID-19 as well. In any event, the point is that huge numbers of people have natural immunity already in place against COVID-19, and not a single one of them needs a vaccine in order to be fully protected. In fact, far better protected than a vaccine recipient is. And yet, the vaccine is continuing to be pushed on everybody. In fact, just this weekend, there was a story about an affair at Madison Square Gardens in New York, in which it was made prominent the fact that in New York, there are now vaccine passports in place. And anybody who wanted to get into that show at Madison Square Garden, which I think was, you know, one of the first reopening events going on in that venue, had to prove that they were vaccinated. This is a craziness. This is an agenda that is unsupported by the science, and the music's coming up and we're going to go, and I got to go. I'm sorry to say it because there was more to say here, but folks, join me again next Wednesday, not tomorrow, but a week from tomorrow. My special guest will be former Senator Pat Kolbeck of Michigan, who is leading the charge against the election fraud issue in Michigan, and has written a new book as well on politics and how it all works. Please join us. We'll have a really good show. Thanks for being with me today. We'll see you next week.
We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiotics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.